The headlines this hour. Iran warns that any unconstructive action at the upcoming IAEA Board of Governors meeting will be met with a strong response. Thousands of people in the occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil mourn a Palestinian woman killed by Israeli forces. And Russia says the U.S. is adding fuel to the fire by planning to supply Ukraine with advanced missile systems.
Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us.
Iran has vowed a strong and proportionate response to any unconstructive action against the Islamic Republic at the upcoming Board of Governors meeting of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said that those using a recent IAEA report on Tehran's nuclear activities as a political tool will be responsible for the ensuing consequences. Saeed Khatibzadeh made the comments after France asked Iran to immediately answer the agency's questions raised in the report about its past nuclear activities. Khatibzadeh said such comments are in line with psychological operations to exert pressure on Iran ahead of the Board of Governors meeting. He said the Israeli regime is behind anti-Iran rhetoric and propaganda. Iran condemns Germany and French statements over the seizure of two Greek tankers in the Persian Gulf over maritime violations. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman has described the statements as one-sided and unjustifiable. Saeed Khatibzadeh says Paris and Berlin should stop defending the vessels that violated the maritime norm and instead uphold legal proceedings based on international laws. German and French foreign ministries have separately criticized the seizure of Greek tankers, calling it a violation of international regulations. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps detained the vessels on Friday. The incident came just days after Greece confiscated an Iranian-flagged oil tanker and delivered it to the U.S. Iran slammed the move as a violation of international law and called for immediate release of the vessel and its cargo. Meanwhile, Greek environmental groups have condemned Athens for causing an oil spill during the transfer of Iranian oil. Palestinians hold a funeral for a woman killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil earlier in the day. The killing has drawn widespread condemnations. The Israeli forces fired tear gas and sound bombs at mourners, bidding farewell to Gufran Warasneh. She was fatally shot near the Al-Arub refugee camp over an alleged stabbing attempt. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has warned that Israeli escalation would increase Palestinians' adherence to resistance. The group's spokesman decried the murder of the 31-year-old Warasneh as a terrorist act. Separately, the Islamic Jihad called for more national efforts to confront the regime's crimes. The Palestinian prime minister also slammed the killing and warned that Israel will be fully responsible for repercussions. Mohammad Shtai urged the international community to boycott the regime. Warasneh was identified as a journalist released from an Israeli jail in April. Correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, joined us earlier with an update on the Israeli shooting. She says the regime's soldiers could have stopped the Palestinian woman if there was a threat, but they fatally shot her without remorse.
The Israeli military claims that Gufran arrived at a semi-checkpoint at the entrance to Al-Arub refugee camp, and she was wielding a knife. This is the Israeli story. And just before she approached even the Israeli soldiers who were conducting, let's say, security search in the area, and in order to make sure that the roads are safety, because these roads are used by Israeli settlers, even if they are at the entrance to the Palestinian refugee camps and Palestinian towns. Immediately, one of the Israeli soldiers decided to shoot her with the live fire. According to the international law, and in case Israeli soldiers or any soldiers felt, threatened, they could use their fire to hinder the movement, let's say, so-called attacker. But in this case, they are claiming that she had a knife. They are claiming that she tried to approach them. And before even she arrived at the checkpoint, she opened fire at her to kill her, not to hinder her movement, to arrest her and question her to see if she was what she was going to do.
Pro-Palestinian professor was forced out of his job at the University of Bristol after the pro-Israel lobby accused him of being anti-Semitic, is vowing to continue advocating for Palestine. This after a new round of opposition emerged online, attempting to silence him for speaking out. Amina Taylor sat down with David Miller for a one-on-one after the latest round of attacks.
A leading scholarly critic of Israeli aggression against Palestinians, is speaking out after renewed attacks surfaced regarding his anti-Zionism work. The social media firestorm erupted after Dr. David Miller shared snippets of an episode of Palestine Declassified, where he's a co-host and co-producer, where the controversial Chabad Lugovitz set was profiled. The Community Security Trust led the latest charge against Dr. Miller, saying they needed to provide specialized anti-terror training as a result of the charges of extremism leveled against the group.
As some people will know watching this, the Community Security Trust has for a long time tried to attack me and was involved in me being sacked from the University of Bristol. And my response to them specifically was to say, well, they have in their charitable objectives, their charity, that they should be educating people about extremism. So my view is that they should be educating the British public about extremist organisations like this one, regardless of whether they're Jewish or Muslim or Christian. But of course they don't and won't do that.
David Miller and his supporters are well aware that there's a coordinated campaign afoot, one that seeks to undermine and smear his name and reputation at every turn. But for Professor Miller, these attacks simply strengthen his resolve. These fresh attacks are the latest in a long line of smears that led to Professor Miller being removed from his post at the University of Bristol. A tribunal on the issue is slated to be held in 2023.
Those who speak up for Palestinian rights will be attacked by Zionist groups, Zionist lobbies, and it will be said that they are anti-Semitic. This is the weapon of choice which they use. But it's not only in the UK. There are numerous other examples in other countries, in Germany, in Austria, in France, in the US, in other countries too. That case, my case, other cases too, they are a sort of warning to other people. You know, don't do this. Don't speak up. Don't tell the truth as you see it, because this will happen to you. And, of course, that frightens many people. What's at stake is that you're not allowed to speak out about Palestine. And if you do, that they will come for you. And we see that, you've mentioned academics. Yes, it affects academics all across the country, but we also see it with other, in other areas. We see counsellors and popular music stars and a whole range of people being attacked.
Like others who've paid a high price for speaking out, Professor Miller refuses to be cowed and will continue fighting for justice for Palestine. Amina Taylor, London.
The Turkish president has once again threatened that his country will carry out a military offensive across the border in Syria. Recep Tayyip Erdogan said that Turkey will rid Tal Rifat and Membiş area in northern Syria of what he called terrorists, an indirect reference to Kurdish militants. He added that Ankara's planned operations will gradually continue in other parts of northern Syria. He said that the move is in line with Turkey's plan to establish a 30-kilometer security zone in Syria. Damascus has condemned Ankara's plan to establish the zone as an act of aggression and an extension of Turkey's ethnic cleansing policy in that area. Russia has accused the United States of adding fuel to the fire by planning to supply Ukraine with advanced missile systems. The Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov called the U.S. action deliberate and on purpose. He said that such arms supplies don't encourage Kyiv to resume peace talks. The spokesman also noted that Washington is using Ukrainian lives in order to maintain its fight against Moscow. On Tuesday, President Joe Biden agreed to provide Ukraine with advanced rocket systems that can strike with precision at long-range Russian targets. This is part of an additional U.S. military aid worth $700 million, which the White House says is aimed at helping Ukraine at the negotiating table with Russia. While NATO continues to supply Ukraine with heavy weapons, our correspondent in Donetsk reports that some of those weapons may be being used to target and kill civilians.
An air raid siren over the separatist-held Donetsk. The Ukrainian army shells this city every day. School 22, an old building. It survived World War II, but not this conflict.
Earlier today, it was reported that two people were killed here, but that's been updated now. Three killed and five injured. And that's just one of the strikes that have happened here in Donetsk today.
My daughter studied here. Luckily, children are studying from home. The teachers were wounded. It's horrible. I don't know where my child is going to study. There's nothing you can comment upon. It's beyond human understanding. They are simply fascists who are trying to eliminate us. That's all. They just want to kill all Donbass people.
Another school nearby also hit. It's clear these institutions have been specifically targeted. There is blood on the pavement.
Yes, we had a horrible day today. We were working when the missile hit. It was big. One person died. Two are injured. One person's in hospital now. It's a very sad situation. For some reason, peaceful civilians are targeted, and they hit schools.
Now, I've covered the strikes by the Ukrainian military on civilian targets here in Donetsk, quite a few of those strikes. But this one here and the one at the other school are on a completely different scale. The ammunition used is far larger. The potential death toll of strikes like this, far greater.
Workmen have put the shell casings on the back of a lorry. The Donetsk People's Republic say this is a 155mm shell, fired by the American-supplied M777 howitzer. 108 of these weapons were delivered to Ukraine by the US. Some have now reached the front line, meaning Ukraine can now blow up schools at a further distance.
If it's proven that NATO weapons were used, what would you say to NATO countries?
They act in a wrong way. Let them come here and see what they give to Ukraine, which is used against us. Let them come and see. I wish in this moment they were here, so they could feel it themselves.
In a battered geography classroom, there's a map of Great Britain and some flags. Today, the children who attend class here are being taught a different lesson about NATO countries, that their weapons are being used to target and kill civilians. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
In Denmark, people are voting in a referendum on whether to scrap their country's decades-old policy of not joining the European Union's common defense policy. Denmark is the only EU member that has a so-called defense reservation and is not bound by the bloc's common security and defense policy. However, recent polls suggest that Danes will vote in favor of abolishing the existing norm. The referendum comes as more European countries have been seeking closer military ties and increasing their defense spending since the beginning of the Russia-Ukraine war. In the latest example, Sweden and Finland have applied for NATO membership, whereas Germany has decided to release more than $100 billion to modernize its army. Russia widening its gas cuts to Europe. Denmark is the latest to see a halt in gas supplies in response to its refusal to pay for gas in rubles. The Danish energy company says it has been informed by Russia's energy giant Gazprom about its decision. That's the day after Gazprom turned off its supplies to the top Dutch trader. Denmark says, however, that it has stored enough gas, could buy more from the European market. Russia has already stopped supplies to Bulgaria, Poland, and Finland, citing their failure to make payments in rubles. Moscow's measures come in response to a host of sanctions that the European Union has imposed on Russia over its war in Ukraine. On Monday, the bloc also agreed to ban Russia's seaborne oil imports and slash Russia's largest bank from the SWIFT system. The new sanctions sent Brent crude prices soaring to $122 a barrel. Former U.S. Army Psychological Warfare Officer Scott Bennett says that Europe will suffer more from the economic war that it has launched against Russia.
Well, it comes down to substance. Russia has material. It has trees. It has oil. It has gas. It has gold. It has food. It has fertilizer. It has the substance of life. Europe has nothing but credit systems and banking systems. And really, credit doesn't matter when you have a war situation. The only thing that matters is material substance. So Europe is basing all of its policy on the hot air and the fantasy that it is, it is essential. It is some sort of social hub that unites all of civilization, and it is not. Russia is faring far better than any other country. The ruble is at record highs. Half the world agrees with Russia. Only European countries do not. And that's really based on a vanity and a silly, soft, pacifist culture that has grown in Europe like a cancer because of the nanny state that the United States has imposed upon it. But if these countries are trying to wean themselves off of Russian oil and gas, perhaps the best thing for Russia to do is to wean them off quickly by yanking the spigot out of their, out of their economies, and letting them get to that place all the more faster. They really want to wean themselves off. Russia has no problem cutting them off tomorrow from every barrel of oil and every container of gas and sell it to China, sell it to India, sell it to South America, sell it to South Africa, sell it to other nations.
Moscow warns that the European Union sanctions on Russian oil will negatively affect the entire Europe, as well as the global energy market. The Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov issued a warning in response to a partial oil embargo by the EU targeting Russia's seaborne oil exports. Peskov said that Moscow is taking measures to minimize the effects of the sanctions approved on Monday. He added that Russia can reroute its oil exports and find alternatives. The EU's latest move is part of a measure to halt around 90% of Russia's oil sales to bloc members by the end of the year. The bloc has imposed 6 rounds of sanctions on Russia since the beginning of the war in Ukraine. Moscow has repeatedly warned that such bans will cause more troubles for the EU than Russia. China has conducted a combat readiness sea and air patrols around Taiwan in response to what it calls collusion between the United States and the self-ruled island. In a statement, the Chinese military has criticized the U.S. for supporting Taiwanese forces, warning that such measures would put the island into a dangerous situation. The statement says the Chinese forces will strengthen their readiness to foil actions by those supporting Taiwan's independence. China's maneuver comes one day after the Taiwanese president acknowledged about plans for cooperation with the U.S. National Guard. Beijing considers Taiwan as part of its territory, but the U.S. has increased its military and diplomatic ties with Taipei. President Joe Biden also angered China recently after he vowed to defend Taiwan militarily if it is attacked by China. Earlier, political analyst Anar Tangen joined us with his take on rising tensions between China and Taiwan.
Well, from Beijing's point of view, it's an obvious provocation by Washington. It's not only sailing warships up and down the Taiwan Straits, but it was, Joe Biden himself, who has 3 times now indicated that he would intervene on behalf of Taiwan in the event of any kind of armed hostilities. And also, the increased arms sales. Tammy Duckworth, a senator, came to Taiwan for an unannounced visit. This is one of many that has occurred. These are all, in Beijing's view, deliberate provocations trying to test edge China into doing something. It's not clear what the U.S. hopes to gain by this, but right now, given this domestic situation in the United States, 77% of the population is concerned about inflation. Yet Biden continues to tout international politics.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
Americans have a gun-crazy culture, armed to the teeth, with some believing that they are the true patriots defending liberty against tyranny, says James Zogby, author, in an article published under the heading, "The U.S. is sick with guns." Stay tuned for more. It's difficult to find words that adequately describe feelings on first learning of the massacre of 19 children and two teachers in Texas recently. There was shock, fear, even nausea, and then disgust at the realization that this nightmare Americans have experienced too many times before was playing out again. As expected, the next day's papers were filled with graphs and charts showing how many mass shootings Americans have had in the United States of America, an average of one a day. How many school massacres Americans have had in the past few decades? Dozens. How many gun homicides? 50 a day. And how many guns are owned by American civilians? More than 400 million. Bottom line, Americans own more guns and have a higher per capita murder rate and mass casualty events annually by far than any other country on planet Earth. No matter how many times Americans are told this and how many outrages they endure, Americans know in their hearts that nothing will be done, and so they are resigned to live in fear, knowing the nightmare will return in their lives. Let's face it, the U.S. is a sick country. Their debate on gun violence can best be described as deranged and pathetic. Republicans and Democrats, fearful of getting in the crosshairs of the gun lobby, refuse to take any action. They refuse to allow even limited controls on guns, arguing that the unfettered right to own weapons is sacred. The solution to gun violence, they argue, is more guns. Having seen legislation to ban assault weapons or place limits on gun purchases routinely defeated, Democrats have either given up trying or being reduced to offering weak proposals. The result? Each new tragedy gives birth to short-lived horror, a bit of finger-pointing, a half-hearted attempt to pass some limited reforms, and then failure. The reality is deeper than policies or legislation. It's not just that American guns are too sophisticated or that they have too many of them. The root problem is the U.S. sick gun culture. U.S. generations grew up playing cowboys and Indians or cops and robbers. If they didn't have cap pistols or toy rifles, they simply improvised with a pointed finger, a thumb trigger, and popo, you're dead. American generations do not play these games. Instead, they act out more fanciful tales of fantasy futuristic heroes, all possessing more potent weapons. But they will also make do, when needed, with sticks or fingers, morphing them into weapons possessed of all sorts of destructive powers. And the video games they play and movies they watch are largely based on killing, killing and killing, so much so that it has become normalized. From cradle to grave, Americans are fed a steady diet of guns and violence. From cartoons, Westerners or cop shows to video games and Quentin Tarantino's Bullet and Blood Fist, guns and shooting and killing are ingrained into their deep culture. Like mom and apple pie, guns have become part of who Americans are as a nation. There is a scene in the film Noir called Classic Gone Crazy where Bart, the film's main character as a young boy, is starting into a store window. The object of his desire is a six-shooter. Unable to resist its call, he shatters the glass and attempts to steal the weapon, only to be arrested in the act. The next scene has Bart standing before a judge trying to explain his obsession with guns. He tells the court, "I feel good when I'm shooting them. I feel awful, good inside, like I'm somebody. Gone Crazy Bart's fixation with the weapon is pathological and it leads ultimately to his demise. When we see the look on the faces of gun enthusiasts lining up to make what they fear may be their last purchase before Democrats take their guns away, we think of Bart. When we watch them sensually cradling their assault weapons or zoned out at the shooting range, we think of Bart, knowing that nothing good can come of it. We know all this, and yet there continues to be a pathological obsession not only with owning weapons, but also with blocking any reasonable controls on their ownership. The modus operandi of this lobby is simple and direct. They allow no discussion, no compromise, no concessions, and no wavering or weakness. And they mask their deadly advocacy with the Constitution, arguing that what is at stake is the very survival of Americans' freedom. In the process, they further inflame the passions of their adherents. In the end, the U.S. has a gun-crazy culture, armed to the teeth with some believing that they are the true patriots defending liberty against tyranny. When we add to this mix all of the resentments and pressures that gave birth to the Tea Party and Trumpism, including a not-so-subtle appeal to race, Americans are left with a dangerous and volatile brew. They will have more angry debates. They may pass some weak and ineffective legislation, and then they will move on to another issue that will distract Americans until the next massacre occurs. And another one will occur, because until they have a prolonged and serious national discussion about their sick love affair with guns and purge themselves of this pathology, they will only be skirting around the edges of an issue that is killing American civilians.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
The audience of IRB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Dr. Shum Ali.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. La hawla wa la quwwata illa billahi al-Aliyy al-Azim. Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen. Wa sallallahu ala sayyidina wa nabiyyina wa abil qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad.
Shallallahu salli ala Muhammad wa
Wa alihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin la siyama baqiyatullah fil aradin jalla Allahu ta'ala farajahu ash-sharif. First, I congratulate you and all lovers of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam for the birth anniversary of Lady Ma'suma salamullah alayha. We are at the beginning of the month of Dhul-Qa'dah, and it's a great month. We have also birth of Imam Rida alayhi salam on the 11th of Dhul-Qa'dah. And some scholars say that this month and the first 10 days of months of Dhul-Hajjah, which is the next month, form very good opportunity for observing Arba'een, for 40 nights if you want to do special a'mal, special muraqabah. So this is very good time. I hope inshallah we can benefit from this month inshallah. Regarding Lady Fatimatul Ma'suma salamullah alayha, alhamdulillah we had some opportunities in the past to talk about her, and also we had those four lectures in the Shrine of Lady Masuma, which later were put into the book The Second Fatima. And Alhamdulillah, the book is now available also in Arabic. One of the brothers from Kuwait has translated to Arabic. And those who have read the book or listened to the lectures, they know that, in my humble opinion, Lady Fatima Atul Ma'suma Salamullah Alayha has a very special role in preparation of the Shia community for end of time. She is not mother of any individual physically. As far as we know, she didn't marry. But she is mother of millions of Shia, because through her love, her warmth, her support, her guidance, her light, many, many generations of scholars have learned in the city of Qom and have taught and have published, and we hope that this would increase before coming of Imam Mahdi Jalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif. Therefore, when Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said, through her intercession, through her shafa'a, our Shia will enter heaven, this makes very clearly sense, because we know that to benefit from someone's shafa'a requires connecting to that person in dunya. If in dunya we have never had any relation with someone, we have never benefited from someone, we have never listened to someone to improve, we are not going to benefit from shafa'a of that person. Shafa'a is not just manifestation of that benefit, because some people think shafa'a is just what you have benefited from someone in the akhirah would be manifest as shafa'a. No, shafa'a is more. Shafa'a is more. Like, for example, if I have learned from my teacher many things, and based on what I have learned, for example, I get 18 out of 20. This 18 result of 18 is manifestation of what was my relation with that teacher was. But if the teacher then intercedes and instead of 18 they give me 19 or 20, this is extra. This is shafa. So shafa is more than just manifestation of what we have benefited from them in dunya. But certainly the key for that, the requirement for shafa, is you must benefit from that person in dunya. You must establish a relation with that person in dunya so that you qualify for their shafa. So when Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says that our Shia will benefit from shafa'a of Lady Fatimatul Ma'suma, this means that the Shia must have benefited in dunya from the light of this lady. Her impact on the Shia community in large is so massive that all the Shia community would be benefiting from her. Maybe I read for you that hadith of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, I read part of the hadith. Tuqbadu fi hamra'atun min wuldi. A lady from my progeny will be departing from this world. Her life will be taken by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the city of Qom. Ismuha Fatima bint Musa. Imam Sadiq says the name of that lady is Fatima, daughter of Musa. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far is the son of Imam Sadiq, and Lady Fatima is grandchild. وَتَدْخُلُ بِالشَّفَاعَتِهَا شِيَعَتِي الْجَنَّةَ بِأَجْمَعِهِمْ. All my Shia, through her Shafa'ah, will enter heaven. So this is a great statement. And as far as I remember, we don't have such a statement for any children of Imam, and even maybe for Imams to have such a statement, at least right now, I don't remember. It's very huge and massive contribution that she must have that would qualify for her right for Shafa'ah. We say in the ziyarah of Lady Fatima, Ya Fatima tushfa'i li fil jannah. فَإِنَّ لَكَ عِنْدَ اللَّهِ شَأْنًا مِنَهَا. She must have permission from Allah. She must have been given a kind of right by Allah to do shafa'ah. فَإِنَّ لَكَ عِنْدَ اللَّهِ شَأْنًا مِنَهَا. And because of this, we expect her to do shafa'ah for us.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen. وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., some Republicans see an opening for a post-Trump candidate in the 2024 presidential election, with so many of Donald Trump's endorsed candidates falling to defeat in recent primaries. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Shane Goldmacher, Maggie Haberman, and Rachel Shorey. The piece is titled Trump's Primary Losses Puncture His Invincibility. Stay with us for more. Donald J. Trump has cast this year's primaries as a moment to measure his power, endorsing candidates by the dozen as he sought to maintain an imprint on his party unlike any other past president. But after the first phase of the primary season concluded on Tuesday, a month in which a quarter of America's states cast their ballots, the verdict has been clear. Donald Trump's aura of untouchability in Republican politics has been punctured. In more than 5 years, from when he became president in January of 2017 until May of 2022, Donald Trump had only ever seen voters reject a half a dozen of his choices in Republican primaries. But by the end of this month, that figure has now more than doubled, with his biggest defeat coming on Tuesday when Governor Brian Kemp of Georgia thrashed the Trump-backed challenger by more than 50 percentage points. Three other Trump recruits challenging Kemp allies also went down to defeat. The mounting losses have emboldened Donald Trump's rivals inside the Republican Party to an extent not seen since early 2016, and increased the chances that, should he run again in 2024, he would face serious competition. "I think a non-Trump with an organized campaign would have a chance," said Jack Kingston, a former Georgia congressman who advised the first Trump presidential campaign. Donald Trump remains broadly popular among Republicans and has a political war chest well north of $100 million. But there has been a less visible sign of slippage. Trump's vaunted digital fundraising machine has begun to slow down. An analysis by the New York Times shows that his average daily online contributions have declined every month for the last 7 months that federal data is available. Donald Trump has gone from raising an average of $324,633 per day in September of 2021 on WinRed, the Republican donation processing portal, to $202,185 in March of 2022, even as he ramped up his political activities and profile. Those close to Donald Trump and even Republicans who aren't caution against misreading the significance of primary losses in which he himself was not on the ballot. Governor Brian Kemp, for instance, took pains not to say a cross word about the former president to avoid alienating his loyal base. "To be the man, you have to beat the man," said Jim Hobart, a Republican pollster with Public Opinion Strategies. And until Trump either bows out of electoral politics or is beaten by a Republican at the ballot box, his strength remains. Rivals, including his own former Vice President Mike Pence, are gearing up for a potential presidential run as he and others visit key early states like Iowa and ramp up their own fundraising operations. Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida has amassed a $100 million re-election war chest and is the talk of many donors, activists, and voters interested in the future of Trumpism without Donald Trump. "Donald Trump had 4 good years, said Cole Muzio, president of the Frontline Policy Council, a conservative Christian group based in Georgia, who voted twice for Mr. Trump, but is now looking for someone more forward-looking. Ron DeSantis is great about seeing where the left is going and playing on the field that they're going to be on, rather than reacting to what happened a couple of years ago," Mr. Muzio said, echoing the frustration that Donald Trump continues to obsess about denying his 2020 election loss. Cole Muzio, whose organization is hosting former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo at his fall gala headliner, spoke as he waited to hear Mike Pence this week in Kennesaw, Georgia, at a rally for Brian Kemp, all names he included in the party's deep bench of 2024 alternatives. Donald Trump still remains the most coveted endorsement in his party, and he has boosted some big winners. Sarah Huckabee Sanders in Arkansas virtually cleared the field for governor with Donald Trump's support, and Representative Ted Budd in North Carolina defeated a past governor to win his party's Senate nomination. Yet the difficult primary season has added to Donald Trump's personal anxieties about his standing, after he has sought to fashion himself as something of an old-school party boss in his post-presidency. He has told advisers he wants to declare his candidacy or possibly launch an exploratory committee this summer. Most of Donald Trump's advisers believe he should wait until after the midterm elections to announce a candidacy. Yet the sense among Republicans that Mr. Trump has lost political altitude is taking hold, including among some of those close to Trump himself. Taylor Bodewich, a Trump spokesman, said the undeniable reality is that Republicans rely on Donald Trump to fuel Republican victories in 2022 and beyond. President Trump's political operation continues to dominate American politics, raising more money and driving more victories than any other political organization, bar none, Mr. Bodewich said. Some Republican strategists have fixated on the fact that so many of Donald Trump's endorsees have landed about one-third of the vote. Big winners, J.D. Vance in Ohio, losers, Jody Heiss in Georgia, Janice McGeachin in Idaho, and Charles Herbster in Nebraska, and those headed for a recount, Dr. Mehmet Oz in Pennsylvania. One-third of the party is at once an unmatched base of unbending loyalists, and yet a cohort far from a majority. Notably, Donald Trump's share of what is raised overall among all Republicans online has also declined. Mr. Trump's main fundraising committee accounted for 19.7% of what was raised by Republican campaigns and committees on Win Red in the last 4 months of 2021, but just 14.1% of what was raised during the first 3 months of 2022. Some of that decrease is the result of other candidates on the ballot raising more this year. Still, only 10 times since July of 2021 has Donald Trump's committee accounted for less than 10% of the money raised on WinRed during a single day. And 9 of those instances came in March of 2022, the last month that data was available. The vocal opposition is no longer just confined to anti-Trump forces inside the Republican Party. Out is also evident in the pro-Trump mainstream. When a triumphant Brian Kemp, whom Mr. Trump had targeted because he refused to go along with his efforts to subvert the 2020 presidential election, arrived in Nashville, Tennessee on Thursday to speak before a gathering of the Republican Governors Association, he received a standing ovation. There is this temptation to engage in wish-casting in which this is the moment in which Trump is slipping, said Charlie Sykes, a conservative anti-Trump commentator. On the other hand, what happened in Georgia was significant. He drew a bright red line, and voters just stampeded across it. Mr. Sykes said the current GOP very much remains Donald Trump's party, even as he saw a distinction between Trumpism and Donald Trump himself. The critical question, as he put it, is whether Republican voters are in a let's-give-him-the-gold-watch-and-let's-move-on mood. Mike Pence, whom Donald Trump publicly condemned as rioters swarmed the Capitol during the certification of the 2020 Electoral College vote, has made travels to early states. A favorite of evangelical voters, he has sought to highlight his support for ending abortion rights as the Supreme Court prepares for a possible decision undoing the landmark Roe v. Wade ruling. Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas, a Republican who has been a hawk on immigration and China since before the Trump presidency, has positioned himself as a potential heir to Trumpism. Tom Cotton has also drawn a contrast with Mr. Trump from the right, vocally criticizing the First Step Act, a criminal justice reform bill that the former president signed into law as a liberal law. Two former top Trump administration officials, Mike Pompeo and Nikki Haley, the former United Nations ambassador, are making endorsements, traveling and building up their political infrastructure. Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina recently announced another trip to Iowa and has been investing heavily in his digital fundraising operation. Tim Scott has said that this will be his last term in the Senate, but he continues to pad a $23.4 million campaign treasury despite facing only token opposition. Mr. Scott has more than 1,000 times as much money as his closest rival, a Democrat with $23,199. Even some of Trump's allies, like right-wing media host Stephen Bannon, speak for a swathe of one-time Trump voters when they condemn the coronavirus vaccines that Donald Trump championed while president. Numerous Republican strategists have argued that Mr. Trump's continued obsession with the 2020 election is an unwanted distraction in 2022, when Democrats hold the levers of power in Washington, and opinion polls show most of the country feels like the nation is moving in the wrong direction.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on May 7, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution on the occasion of the International Al-Quds Day. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, in his speech on the occasion of International Quds Day, referring to the change in the balance of power in favor of Islamic world and Palestine, emphasized, I tell you with confidence the downward movement of the Zionist regime has started and will not stop.
The electoral events in the U.S. and the notoriously scandalous failures of the hubristic and arrogant managers in that country, the unsuccessful one-year fight against the pandemic in the U.S. and Europe, and the embarrassing incidents that ensued and also the recent political and social instabilities in the most important European countries are all signs of the downward movement of the Western camp. On the other hand, the growth of the resistance forces in the most sensitive Islamic regions, the development of their defensive and offensive capabilities, their growth of self-awareness, motivation and hope in Muslim nations, the increasing tendency to follow Islamic and Quranic slogans, and the growth of independence and self-reliance in nations are auspicious signs of a better future.
Every day we tell each other that this day will be the last, and tomorrow we all can go home free, and all this will finally end. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free.
In this auspicious future, cooperation between Muslim countries should be a main and fundamental goal, and this does not seem unlikely. The pivot around which this cooperation turns is the issue of Palestine, the entirety of that country, and the fate of Holy Quds. This is the same truth that guided the enlightened heart of the great Imam Khomeini, may God bestow mercy upon him, towards the announcement of International Quds Day on the last Friday of Ramadan. Cooperation between Muslims around the pivot of Holy Quds is an absolute nightmare for the Zionists and for their American and European advocates. The failed project called the Deal of the Century and the effort to normalize the relations between a few weak Arab governments and the Zionist regime were desperate attempts to run away from that nightmare.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.